The criminal profile has become a staple not only in forensics, but in books, films, and TV shows. And while fans of Mindhunter or Criminal Minds might be familiar with the tools of the trade, many don't know its origins. Ron Fancell's new book, Shadow Man, An Elusive Psycho Killer and the Birth of FBI Profiling, traces the largely unknown tragic backstory of this development in criminology. Ron Fancell is an award-winning journalist and the author of 8 books of true crime and 3 novels, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe, for making time for me. I'm glad to be here.
It's very nice to have you on the program. Again, the name of the book is Shadow Man, An Elusive Psycho Killer and the Birth of FBI Profiling. What brought you to this particular story?
The secret of my success as a writer, I think, is that I never pick a story that I can screw up. And Shadow Man struck me as one of those stories. It had this powerful universal stuff, like a mother's anguish and persistence and the fear of the dark. I heard about it for the first time. I was a senior writer at the Denver Post, and my job was covering the American West, and I traced across it at that time. But all I knew, really, was there was a kidnapping and ultimately a profile, and that was about it, really. So I filed it away as something to look into later, and just didn't come back to it for a long, long time. But when I finally did, and as I looked into it a little bit more, I discovered it was more than a simple kidnapping. It was a lot more. There was this grotesque series of crimes in a part of the country where I grew up. And plus, you had this moment in forensic history that honestly, nobody had ever told the story. So I was fascinated by that. And like any journalist or any author, I thought this was a chance to tell a story that wasn't and hadn't been retold over and over and over again. And it had some consequence to it. So that's what happened. That's the kind of story I like.
So let's bring us to Montana and this manhunt. We go back to June 1973. Give us the setup.
Michigan family is on a grand western vacation. They end up in a small Montana park where they have great fun. They go to bed one night. 4 of the 5 children in the family squeeze into a tent, and that's where they spend the night. The next morning, one of them gets up and notices there's a big hole cut in the back of the tent, and their little sister, 7-year-old Susie Yeager, is gone. And at first, they're thinking maybe she pushed through the tent, maybe it, you know, ripped on its own, and she went out, you know, to go to play or to go to the bathroom. But very quickly they realize she's nowhere. They can find her nowhere. When they begin to fear the worst, they call the sheriff, and the sheriff ultimately calls the FBI. Within the first day or two, 1,000 people literally are beating the bushes looking for this little girl, and they come up with nothing. So the FBI has nothing. They have no evidence. They have no witnesses. They, at the time, have no leads. So they have no suspects. And this goes on, not just days, not just weeks, but for months. And the frustration builds incredibly. So that's where this all begins.
So ultimately, a special agent with the FBI, Pete Dunbar, attends this workshop at FBI headquarters in Quantico. 2 agents
right.
had been working on this idea that what if criminals left a psychological trail, and what if that would lead investigators then to them? So what ultimately happens is Patrick Mullaney, a trained psychologist, and Howard Teton, who is a veteran criminologist, look at this and say, okay, we need a behavioral science unit to explore this idea called criminal profiling. So how do the two sides, if you will, come together and start to work on this case in particular?
Sure. And let me interject here that there was another crime that happened between the disappearance of this little girl and the actual profile. And that was the disappearance of a teenage waitress in this little dinky town. They ultimately found her car hidden on a remote abandoned ranch. And around this ranch, they found shards of bone had been scattered. The Smithsonian examined that and ruled that indeed the bones had probably come from this teenage waitress. They fit that description. But among those bones, they found bones of a little girl. And now the FBI is thinking maybe we have one killer, one set of killers instead of two separate crimes. The frustration has built. They have that little bit, but they still have no suspects. They have no witnesses, anything. It's on an ordinary visit back to Quantico that this lead FBI agent, a guy named Dunbar, Pete Dunbar, happens to hear a workshop by two fellow agents. And as you said, they had expertise in both psychology and in crime scene evaluation. And they had this idea that you described, that you could look at the crime scene and know a little bit about the perpetrator. After it was over, he followed them back to their offices and said, I have these two cases, and maybe you can help me because I have nothing else. They looked at his case file ultimately, and they said, well, maybe we can help, and maybe this is the one where we should try to see if it works. And that's what happens. They contrive about a 20-point profile of different elements that they believe apply to this particular unknown subject, the unsub, and they give it to the FBI agent in charge, and things take on new life. But not everybody's aboard with the idea of profiling, and so they're kind of fighting that at the same time.
Talk a little bit about that. Why was it dismissed or resisted by most law enforcement, including J. Edgar Hoover, by the way? But also, especially
That's right.
when you look at that profile that you mentioned a moment ago, that out of the 16 profile elements, 15 of those are dead on.
It's amazing. And that's without a roadmap. That's without
right.
knowing what they were really doing. Today, it's different. Today, we have thousands and thousands of interviews with killers. We have a database. We have experts in forensic psychology, et cetera. Back then, they had none of that. There's a lot of intuition and experience and logic going in, a little bit of guesswork, too. But they had no roadmap. So they were also kind of swimming upstream because, as you point out, J. Edgar Hoover's doesn't like this idea. Cops on the street and deputies out there believe that the way you solve crimes is a lot of footwork. It's talking to a lot of people, and it's kind of Sherlockian deduction. And they were pushing back against this voodoo, this pop psychology crap that they think it isn't really what they say, and they're not going to be able to do this accurately. So it took approving that it had some value. And again, they looked at this case as maybe the case that they could do a profile on for the first time and do themselves a favor by making it fairly accurate.
Ron Fancell is our guest. The name of the book is Shadow Man. Give us a sense of what goes into the creation, at least in these early cases, what goes into a criminal profile, the ingredients of a criminal profile, and how that is built ultimately.
Well, again, let's go back to they had no roadmap. They were just relying on their experience with psychology and crime scenes. So a lot of this was deduction in that sense. They had done a couple of interviews with, particularly with a serial killer known as Ed Kemper. And he gave them a lot of information, and they based probably a little more than they should some of their deductions on the interviews they did with Ed Kemper. That there was a lot of presumption that sexual elements in their lives played a big role. That's not quite as true today as they believed it was back then, but it is present. They believed relationships in the family and that sort of thing. But some of it was simple logic. I'll use one example. We all know today that the typical serial killer tends to be a white male in his 20s. That kind of goes without saying anymore. And that's because we have all this data. But back then they didn't. They merely deduced that this killer was a white male in his 20s because the crimes required this astounding degree of stealth and strength that suggested that this guy had military experience. Of course, during Vietnam, that was largely male. The fact that he had some knowledge of surroundings so that he could literally disappear into the shadows, and that he knew local law enforcement was not quite what you'd find in the big city, suggested that he was local. And in this little rural county in western Montana, it was 99% white population. So all of these things added up to them that he's a white male in his 20s. And that's kind of emblematic of their thinking throughout.
And this was something where this guy is living in a small town. People are living with him, communicating with him every day, and have no idea this guy is a killer.
Yeah, in fact, you're correct. And in fact, they believe that couldn't be one of them. Small towns believe we know everybody. We even know everything about everybody. And that was their belief. And of course, you got to understand at that time, Manson's trial had ended just a year or so before. Watergate is starting to bubble up. Vietnam protests to those people in that particular place. Long-haired hippies were the genesis of a lot of evil happening in the country. So it must be an outsider. And that presumption that it was an outsider, of course, reflects that it couldn't be an insider. And so a lot of names pop up a little bit later in the investigation that are local, but they all get dismissed because they don't look like killers. They just don't sound like killers.
One of the things that is so amazing about this book is that you have to keep telling yourself, okay, in the grand scheme of things, this was not that long ago, going back to 1973, 1974, and yet they weren't even using the term serial killer at this point.
No, it wasn't even in our vernacular at that point. That's five, 6 years later that the FBI's then profiling unit kind of started to recognize the psychological connections between these, and they were perfecting that knowledge. And I think it was John Douglas or Robert Ressler who were in that next generation and who are well known, came up with that term. And so we're not even using that terminology at the time, but moreover, we're not looking at crimes connected in the same way. We knew one guy might kill 10 people, but we weren't really putting the psychological elements together, and that's key in serial killing.
So at what point after this is used, they identify the killer. So how long after that does this become a regular practice? And something, even though many look down their nose at it and still do, it becomes an actual accepted practice within the Bureau.
Well, they keep doing their interviews, keep accumulating knowledge. They hire a few people like Ressler and John Douglas who are in the next generation. And it moves that way and continues to grow a little bit by bit. Then along in the late 70s, somebody's killing young women, and they're looking at this, and they bring this practice to bear on that case. And ultimately that leads to Ted Bundy, and the rest is history, so to speak. It's one of its very first successes is Ted Bundy. And so we know what has happened then. Sort of the golden age of serial killers has come out of that. And profiling played a big role. And, of course, it plays a big role in our media now, too.
The book is fascinating, and it's called Shadow Man, an Elusive Psycho Killer and the Birth of FBI Profiling. It is published by Berkeley. Ron Francell, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for making time for me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Shadow Man. It is published by Berkeley by Ron Francell. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.